and welcome to the Oxygen Addict Triathlon Podcast. We're brought to you every week by our sponsors, precisionhydration.com, electrolytes in different strengths that match how you sweat, and Precision Fuel 30 gels and drink mixes. Let's not forget them, new kids on the block, to give you enough carbohydrates to perform at your best. You can get 15% off your first order with the code OXYGENADDICT15. Man, what a way to start the show. That was a smooth ad read, wasn't it? Do you know, I read so many years the Precision Hydration ad. It's in my head, and now they've changed it and added the fuel gels and the fuel drink mixes. I never remember to do it. Man, they are delicious, though, so get on them. If you've not tried it, get on them. Okay, guys, I hope you are well. Today's edition is going to be all about the 70.3 World Championships that just took place over in St. George. We've got some news from the pros, we've got some news from the age groupers, we've also got another couple of races to round up on. There's some amazing racing happened out in Austria in particular. I'm not going to be able to go over all of the races like I would usually do. I had a look and we've got to the point where there are just so many races happening over the coming weekends. It's just going to be too many. So I'm concentrating on the big ones. So let's kick it off. Let's kick it off by talking about the 70.3 World Championships. And from my point of view as a triathlon coach, as a British person, I think pretty unanimously, this is one of the triathlon performances of all time, relative to field strength and relative to everybody else. A total, total domination by Lucy Charles Barclay of Great Britain. It was the strongest all-round triathlon performance that I can remember seeing in recent years. She is absolutely come of age. There've been a little bit of question marks about her run on some of the performances in previous years, but she answered all of the naysayers and all of the doubters with this performance. Just incredible. I'll go through the splits here. She had the fastest swim, the fastest bike, and the fastest run of the day. There's no doubting that world championship title on her shoulders. She swam 24:35, which, to put it in context, was over a minute and a half faster than any other woman. So she was out of transition and on her bike before the other women were out of the water. And there's some quality athletes behind her. We had Taylor Nibb racing, right? So someone who is at the very front pack of ITU racing. She's absolutely destroyed that field. It's one of the strongest swim performances I think I can remember seeing in living memory. She then biked 2:14. So she was 2-3 minutes clear of the next fastest rider. And that wasn't Taylor Nibb. That was Kat Matthews. So she had a storming race as well. She ended up coming through to finish fourth. And then Lucy Charles Barclay ran 1:18:47 to round it out. So in old money, that's 6 minute miling. That's the classic 6 minute milers half marathon to close. And if you didn't see it, it would be worth you going back and it would be worth you watching some of the video of the run course in particular. It was incredibly steep and hilly. Some of the uphills and the downhills are so steep, especially the downhills. It reminded me of seeing the fell runners coming down the runs at Helvellyn. We must be talking, I don't think I'm exaggerating to say 1 in 5, 1 in 6 on the way down the hills there. There was a section where Lucy Charles Barclay was coming around one of the corners. It had rained and the road was obviously slick. And you could see that she was going so fast and trying to control herself so much. She ran out into the road and almost went out past the cones into the other side of the road, as it were. So really steep downhills. And anyone who's done that kind of racing knows it is as hard, if not harder, to run those downhills quickly as it is to run the uphills quickly. An absolutely consummate performance from her. I'm delighted because she's been, you know, she's had some good big wins, but she's been perennially the bridesmaid. And to see her get the first world championship win, I'm just totally stoked and made up for her. You can go back in the archives. We had Lucy on one of the original podcasts. I'm trying to wrap my brains now. Maybe 2015 after Ironman UK, 2016, when she raced as an age grouper for her first Ironman. So we had a quick snippet of her there, and we've had her on over the years as well. So I just want to say congratulations to her and her team. It's fantastic to see her get that world championship title. Jeannie Metzler came through. She had a cracking one. Ran down Taylor Nibb. She was running really, really strong. She did brilliantly to come through for second place. Taylor Nibb held on for third. Again, we had Taylor on a few weeks ago. She's just an awesome talent. She will race everybody, anybody, any distance, name it, super sprint, relay, Olympic distance, half iron distance. I think this was her second, am I right saying her second 70.3? I think she finished second at Boulder 70.3. And she'd done the Collins Cup before this at middle distance. So go back a few weeks and listen to her interview. She's a great kid. Super, super enthusiastic. She was riding a road bike, if you can believe that, a road bike with a disc wheel and with a whole bunch of gels taped to the top tube. So there's all manner of age group aerodynamics home experts being sick into the headphones as they listen to that with the disc wheel road bike combo and the gels on the top tube. But God bless her, man. She makes it work. She is fast. And when she gets on a TT bike, when she gets comfy and dialed in on a TT bike, I think we could be looking at the next, if not the next 70.3 world champion, then definitely she is going to be much, much more in contention. When you think she was only, what's the difference there? 3.5 minutes down on LCB on the bike, riding the road bike. A minute of that's got to be in just the, you know, just the stuff hanging out in the air. So yeah, interesting. When she gets those details dialed in, she's going to be an absolute, even more of a force to be reckoned with. Then on the Great Britain front, I mean, talk about a wealth of results to choose from. Kat Matthews in fourth. Brilliant to see her going so well. I think the second fastest bike split of the day and a 1:22 run to close that out for fourth. Outrunning Emma Pallant-Brown. So, you know, great result from both of those in fourth and fifth. We then had Holly Lawrence in eighth, Nikki Bartlett in ninth. So just amazing to have so many in the top 10. Over on the men's side, well, what can be said? He's a confident guy. He was a confident guy going into this. He didn't have the race he wanted at the Olympics. He was a defending 70.3 world champion and he absolutely dominated it. Now, the only slight asterisk here is what would have happened if Christian Blumenfeld hadn't punctured? It would have been an absolutely amazing foot race with the two of them against each other, that's for sure. But as it was, he said in his post-race interview, and the Norwegians, they, you know, they get criticized a lot, especially if you read the American forums, they get criticized for being arrogant. And I don't think it's that. They're self-confident and they're blunt. And it's something to do with, I've got a lot of friends over in Scandinavia. It's just something about the culture. They say things as it is. They say it as they see them. If they believe they're the best, they'll say that they believe they're the best. If they believe other people should have shown up to race them, they'll say that. And they said that, and they'll get criticized for it in some quarters, but I love it. I love that their personalities who are not afraid to say what they think. You know, they wanted to see Jan racing. They wanted to see the other names that have been mentioned racing. And whether or not Jan, Ali, whoever else didn't show up because of injury, I'm sure they would have wanted to be there, whether it's soreness post the Collins Cup, who knows, right? But they wanted to be racing those big names. But as it is, hats off to Gustav Iden. Hat off to him, in fact. Go back and listen to the interview we did with him a while back now. It's probably about a year ago. There's a great story about him finding his lucky hat on the roadside and it leading to a sponsorship deal with Giant Bicycles, which is brilliant in itself. But he rode that bike like he stole it. He rode a 1:58.58 on the St. George course. I think he was one of only two guys to go under the two-hour barrier. He rode smart. He rode with the lead pack for, I'd say, 40 miles, and then he just destroyed everyone over the last 15, 20 miles of that bike course on the big climb. He came into T2 with a four-minute lead, and he didn't give it up at all. Sam Long ran strong to come through to take the silver, but he was still, I don't know, he was still 4 minutes behind at the finish, and Gustav closed it out with the strongest run of the day. Daniel Backegaard there held on for third place. The race kicked off with Ben Canute going very well in the swim, and interestingly for me, Christian Blumenfeld getting on his feet, and the two of them got away. And as I was watching the early part of this race, I thought, well, this is could well be game over for everybody else. You can't give Christian Blumenfeld a minute in the swim and let him get away and expect to reel him back in. And without that puncture, who knows what would have happened? Would he have ridden on his own? Would Gustav have bridged up to him and the two of them ridden away together? We know that the pair of them had a cracking race out in the Middle East together where they set two of the fastest times of all time. I'm struggling to remember which Middle Eastern race it was, about 2 or 3 years ago. But Christian took the victory there over Gustav. So it would have been a great race. And I feel like we were robbed of an amazing foot race. And we know that Christian loves to race head to head on the run. And having an adversary like Gustav there to race would have brought out the best in him. So I'm gutted for all of us that we didn't get to see that. But who knows, we may well get to see that in the Ironman World Championships. Should that happen in February? Should that happen in February in Kona? Should it happen in April in a moved venue? Now, I mentioned last week it wasn't a rumor. It was actually CEO Andrew Messick saying they were looking at potential other venues because it didn't feel like they might be able to hold the event in Kona with the way the COVID situation is there. There are rumors building on the ground that there are talks afoot to hold the World Championships. I'm going to stoke the rumors here by repeating them. Hold the World Championships in St. George in either late April or early May. So you maybe didn't hear it here first. But those are the rumors. There's also a very interesting fact that a friend of mine pointed out to me. Ironman Lanzarote has not yet opened up for entries for the coming season, and usually it would have done. Now, maybe that's a knock-on from coronavirus as well, but if you are looking for a classic venue with a long, long history of Ironman racing, they're into their 30th year on an island that's got very similar weather and very similar terrain to Kona, couldn't do better than Lanzarote. I personally would love to see the World Championships come to Europe. I would love to see them go to Lanzarote. Anyone who's been to Lanzarote knows, you know, the depth of feeling that the people have got there. So many Europeans, Brits, Germans go out there to train already. It's a fantastic one-loop bike course. The potential to, I think as the run course is as it is, perhaps not that classic for a World Championships, but the potential to do something there and make it a Kona-esque run course could be just utterly magnificent. So keep your fingers crossed. Any more rumors, I'll do my damnedest to spread them like the good internet rumor monger that I am. Because let's be honest, I'm not a journalist. I'm just a guy doing a podcast as a fan, right? But I will bring you those rumors as I hear them going forwards. So there we go. That's the Ironman 70.3 World Championships. Other massive race that happened this weekend, usually it's a June race, it was Ironman Austria. And again, I wondered whether to talk about any other races other than the 70.3 World Championships. I couldn't not mention Ironman Austria. It is one of the greatest races on the Ironman European calendar. It's up there with Lanzarote, with Frankfurt, with Roth as, you know, one of the classic, fast, amazing courses. Loads of my athletes have raced it over the years, and every single one of them, to a man and woman, have come back and said, that is the greatest race I've ever done. Even people who've raced Kona have come back honestly saying, that was a better experience than Kona. It's an amazing venue with a swim that's in a crystal clear lake and finishes with 800 meters up a, I don't want to say canal, that gives the wrong impression, but it's a 10 meter wide crystal clear water that you'd swim up to the transition area. Very fast bike course with very smooth tarmac, great for riding on, and a fantastic, interesting run. And I'm mentioning it partly because of its history, but some of the performances that happened this weekend are just staggering. On the male side, Denis Chevreau took the win. He went 7:51 and broke the existing run course record. Get this, he ran 2:35.18, which, you know, mind-blowing. Mind-blowing. Rasmus Svenningsson in second broke the existing bike course record. He went 4:09 on the bike. So just amazing performance there. And there was only 22 seconds between the two of them at the finish. Now, I've not been able to get a full write-up or hear from people who saw the finish, whether they were side by side during the marathon and somebody broke away, whether Ron was running the other down. I just don't know. I'd love to find out if you know. Maybe tweet me or Instagram me about what happened there. And if you've got any videos of clips and stuff, send them to our Instagram. I'll gladly repost them. And Arnaud Guillot from France, He took third in 7:58. So all three of the men there under 8 hours. Great racing. Love it. But a 2:35 marathon, that's moving the bar even faster. I'm not sure. Is that? I don't think that's as fast as Matt Hansen went in Texas. I think he went 2:34, but it's certainly one of the fastest runs of all time. Over on the female side, Laura Phillip broke the female course record by 6 minutes, and she was 5 minutes, five of those 6 minutes were on the run. She closed with a 2:44.48 run, breaking Rinne's run course record by 5 minutes. Now, talk about your all-time classic best runners in Ironman. Rinne was, you know, no argument, one of the best runners, if not the best Ironman runner of all time. To go 5 minutes faster than her course record there is an astonishing performance. So Laura Phillips splits here 54:19, 4:50, and 2:44.48 for an 8:35 overall. Again, she's been on the podium in Kona. I've had her on the show, and she's a lovely, lovely lady. She's just super, super excited about Ironman in general, and almost like stumbled into the sport because she lived miles away from where she was at university and was biking to university and back. So she's an absolute axe. Fastest swim, fastest bike, and fastest run of the day to go 8:35 and break the course record. What an amazing performance. She's absolutely stamped herself into the top three, top five favorites for the World Championships with a performance like that. Yeah, absolutely mind-blowing. Really, really cool. Also, always a massively popular age group race, Ironman Austria. We had three from Team Oxygen Addict out there racing. It's been a long and difficult and winding journey to get there. People had wanted to race in June of 2020 originally, and it got postponed to June of 2021 and then back to September. And, you know, would it happen? Would it not happen? Had team members who ended up pulling out because they were convinced wasn't going to happen, or they weren't going to be able to travel. And the travel actually only happened relatively at the last minute. It was really right down to the wire. But I am very pleased and proud to say that our fantastic trio of Team Oxygen Addict ladies who were racing all managed to get themselves to the finish line. So Ruta Ratavi, Jesse Hassel, and Chelsea Knight managed to get themselves to the finish line. Jesse Hassel, a lot of you who race Bowood will know as one of the queen leaders of the mayhem there. She was the cheerleader with the pink hair on the day. And Jesse managed to race, get this, her race day nutrition were two massive Austrian pretzels, one hung over each of the brake levers of her road bike, which I just love. She's an absolute maniac in the best possible way. So Jesse, Chelsea, and Ruta, well done. It's great to see you get yourself to the finish line of the Ironman after all your hard work over the last, what, 2.5, 3 years now? Really well done. Super proud of you. Right. Before we go into this week's interview of the week, I just want to give a shout out to our sponsors, Precision Hydration. There's not a one-size-fits-all approach when it comes to hydration because we all sweat differently. We all sweat different amounts. That's the volume of liquid that we lose. And we all sweat different concentrations of sodium within that. So if you're both a heavy sweater and a highly concentrated sodium sweater like I am, some people might lose as little as 200 milligrams of sodium per liter, whereas I lose 1,000 milligrams of sodium per liter. So I have to replace that sodium. And I know people who typically suffer with a lot of cramps or end up on hot days with like white salt caked all over the kit. You are a very heavy or very high sodium percentage sweater. And we have to replace that sodium in order to stay hydrated. It's not as simple as just pouring water in. We need liquid that is the same, like isotonic, the same concentration of sodium as we're losing. So if you are not sure about this, to help you nail your hydration strategy, go over to precisionhydration.com. They can provide you with personalized recommendations for the amount you need to drink and the concentration of electrolytes. They've got an online sweat test you can take. You can have a free call with their experts to work out your electrolyte needs and your fueling needs, because they're now also doing for fueling what they've done for hydration. So they're helping you understand how much carbs you need per hour for the races that you're doing and the size of body you've got. So again, on the website, they've got a quick carb calculator. You can get fueling recommendations for you and the races that you're doing. Okay, they've got these great Precision Fuel 30 gels with 30 grams of carbs in each one, and Precision Fuel 30 drink mix that's got both 30 grams of carbs and it's also got electrolytes in. So you can work out exactly how many grams of carbs you are putting into your drink and you know exactly how much you're taking in. So athletes of mine who use this rave about the products because they know exactly how much they're taking and they can be absolutely certain how many grams of carbohydrate they've got in them. During training and also on race day. So they're sure that they've hit the nutritional targets before they get onto the run. So head over to precisionhydration.com and use the code OXYGENETIC15 to get 15% off your first order. Okay, we're going to head over to this week's interview of the week with Team Oxygen Addict athlete John Knutson, who has just raced the 70.3 World Championships in St. George. Welcome to the Oxygen Addict Triathlon podcast. You'll be no stranger to team members who will have heard your dulcet tones before on our team calls, but to the wider podcast audience, maybe not quite so much. And I'm really grateful we get the chance to get you on and hear about the 70.3 World Championships in St. George from the horse's mouth, as it were, from the mouth of someone who was there in the teeth of the battle, battling the other competitors as well as the course and the elements, as it turned out, as I'm sure we're gonna hear. So first up, how are you feeling post St. George? Are you recovering okay?
Yeah, I'm recovering pretty well. It's feeling a bit in my glutes, you know, and especially my quads the last couple of days after running down those hills, but I think I'm recovering pretty well now. Kind of anxious to get in the water because that usually really seems to make me feel a lot better. But
hey, well, people who haven't seen the video, and it even took me by surprise. I knew I'd seen it before, seen it in the 70.3 St. George race where Sanders and Long had that head-to-head earlier in the year, and it was obvious there were some steep uphills and downhills there. But for some reason, the video of it this time really gave a context to how steep some of those downhills were. There was a shot of Lucy Charles Barkley coming around one of the corners in the wet, and it looked like she was going so fast she nearly didn't make it around the corner. Do you know what I mean? It looked, yes, looked like exactly. A really brutal course on your legs, hey?
Yeah, it was, and it took me a bit by surprise even on race day. You know, I'd seen the elevation profile and I thought, well, we're going to be running downhill at the end, that's great. But I saw Sam Long post on social media about how there's some really steep spots, and I'm like, well, how steep is it going to be on a triathlon race course, you know? And then I think I saw Christian Blumenfeld post something similar and I said, wow, it must really be steep. And it still surprised me. I don't know what the grade was, but that last really steep downhill was tough. I couldn't even go all out, you know, after riding and running for 5 hours. I think I was spending more energy breaking down the hill than actually running down the hill.
That's definitely how it looked. What would you estimate it would be? It looked to me like it was like 1 in 5, 1 in 6. And it might be the context of the TV cameras, but the way the runners were running, it really looked as though, you know, some of them were really kind of like waving their arms as they ran downhill, like a fell runner would do coming down really steep stuff. And I'm sure it's not as steep as a, you know, the fell runner type stuff, but it's about as steep as graded roads get, right?
Yeah, I think so. You don't see many roads that steep, not around here.
It's not what you need in the closing miles of a 70.3, let alone the World Championships, right?
Well, I'm just glad we weren't running up that portion. There was plenty of uphill running, but that, at least we didn't have to run up that. It would have been more like a hike, I think.
Yeah, I think so, definitely. All right, so listen, we kind of come in at the end here. I want to go back and hear a little bit about you and about your journey into triathlon. So first up, tell us a bit about yourself. Where are you from? What age are you? What do you live? What do you do for a living? All that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I'm 43 years old. I live in Minnesota in the United States. I'm from Iowa originally, just south of here, for listeners who might not know U.S. geography that well. I am a software engineer consultant by trade. And as far as triathlon goes, I guess I've always kind of considered myself a runner. I was
okay
in my younger life. I was in the U.S. Army and I was always one of the faster runners in that stage. And then throughout my life after the Army, I'd go through bouts of just running for fitness, and I'd always run too hard and I'd end up injuring myself, usually triggering my back, my lower back injury. And then I wouldn't run for a year or two. So a few years ago, I think about 2014, I did an obstacle course race and did a little bit of training in between there. The next year I did another one. The next year I did it again. And then I decided I wanted to try out some road races, and why not try a marathon? So I started training for my first marathon in 2017. And then I think sometime in that, the point of training for that, I learned about Ironman. I was familiar with triathlons, but not really Ironman races. And at the same time, I started hearing about a local swim race they do here, which is a 5-mile swim, almost 10K swim across one of our bigger lakes. And I thought, oh, that'd be nice to do someday, but I could barely swim a pool length at the time. So I decided to set a goal at first for a triathlon. Basically taught myself how to swim, took one weekend workshop, and then the rest was kind of on my own, and learned how to swim enough to get through a sprint triathlon. And then I signed up for my first Ironman, which was in Chattanooga in 2019.
Nice.
All downhill since then.
Properly in at the deep end. One sprint triathlon and then straight into Ironman.
Well, so I did have a 70.3 scheduled before my first Ironman, which would have been June of 2019. But you probably remember I had a bike accident and broke my elbow 2 weeks before that race.
Yeah.
So aside from a sprint, the Ironman was my first full distance events, nothing in between.
I love it. I love these stories, man. So you were a runner as a kid, and then like the classic story of, as we get older, we try and run as fast as we used to when we were a kid, get a niggle, get injured, take some time off, get back into running, run fast, get a niggle, get injured, take some time off. And you've ended up in triathlon as a kind of multi-sport training way to sort of expand your athletic ability in your in the age that you are now. So were you turning 40 when you did your first Ironman in Chattanooga then? Would it have been about then? You'd have been 41 maybe, would you?
Yeah, 41. I would have been turning 42 a couple months after that.
Yeah, okay. So your story is interesting then, because it's going to resonate with a lot of people, I think, who listen, and that triathlon really, well, less and less of these days, I suppose, but it tends to be a kind of middle-age onset sport. It's something that is picked up by people. And there's more kids coming into the sport now, I think, as triathletes. Now it's in the Olympics and people are watching that, but it didn't used to be common. It's always been adults coming into it from a single sport background and trying to find a way. In your case, trying to find a way to swim. In swimmers' cases, it's the opposite, and they're trying to learn a way to run. But that's really the interesting story that crosses over with so many people, I think, in that you come into triathlon in middle age, and then you find actually those habits that you had from a kid of being a runner and having good aerobic fitness cross over and translate really well into biking and into swimming, and you find yourself quite decent at a sport quite quickly that you're still quite a novice at almost.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I have this huge base, aerobic base, from all the running I did, and that translated pretty well to the bike. I don't place as well on the bike as I do running, but I still place pretty well generally, and that's only improved obviously the more bike training I do. But yeah. Exactly. I from the get-go, I started off pretty well ranked, I feel like, locally anyway, in the bike legs.
Yeah. And it's a nice position to be in if you come from a running background, because you find yourself kind of like passing people all through the day.
Absolutely.
You kind of have no idea where you are in the water. You pass people on the bike, pass people on the run, and it's a real sort of positive spiral through the whole day, isn't it?
Absolutely. That's the only upside of being one of the slower swimmers, I guess, too.
So tell us about your first Ironman in Chattanooga then. How did that go?
It went great. It was more than I expected, but it was a really hot one. It was, I think the top temperature was 102 degrees Fahrenheit that day.
Wow.
The water was 82 degrees.
Yeah, I remember it being really hot.
So just under the wetsuit forbidden temperature, but I remember they were telling us you can wear a wetsuit, but please, we recommend you don't. And we saw people who wore wetsuits, they just cooked and swam, and they were tapping out 10 miles into the bike ride because they'd overheated already. And so me not being the most experienced swimmer, it was just kind of a trial by fire here, no wetsuit, go swim 2.5 miles. And I'm actually pretty grateful that that happened to me, because now I, even at the World Championships, there were a lot of people who seemed to be worried about it being a non-wetsuit swim. And having gotten that out of the way with my first Ironman, I'm not worried about that anymore. I haven't actually done a race longer than a sprint where I've been allowed to wear a wetsuit. So Des Moines earlier this year was a non-wetsuit swim. And the World Championships was a non-wetsuit swim. So I don't stress that anymore, because I got my first one out of the way early on. So
yeah.
So that was the swim. The swim was quick, but it was great. I remember coming around the final turn buoy and just grinning and feeling this elation, because that was my biggest concern, and I knew I could bike 100 miles and walk 26 miles if I had to after that. So so I knew I was going to finish. So at that point, it was just see how well I could do. And other things I still remember really well about that, aside from the heat, was that I actually missed my special needs bag on the bike. So I had a moment of panic when I hit the second lap and realized what I'd done. And I was out of fluids, and I was out of nutrition. So I had to compensate. I went full stop at the next aid station, and I picked up bananas and energy bars, and I refilled my bottles I had on my bike with Gatorade, which wasn't what I'd been training with, but you know, it's so hot, I had to have fluids, I had to have electrolytes.
Yeah.
And, just kind of made the best of a bad situation and got through it that way. Then starting out the run, I remember feeling great for the first half a mile, and then starting up the first hill in the heat and the sun and feeling like I was going to blow up, and not feeling like I could run at all because it was so hot. And I looked at my watch and realized that I could walk the whole thing and still finish in time if I needed to, but thankfully I didn't need to. After a couple miles, I was able to start running a little bit at a time. I think 4 or 5 miles in, I was able to run between the aid stations. By the halfway point, I was running pretty consistently, passing people, everyone saying, wow, great pace, you know. And by the time the sun went down, I was feeling really good again. One thing that should have been a clue to me then, but I didn't figure out until very recently, was how much salt I go through. But I say it should have been a clue to me then, is because I was just Cookie Monster shoveling potato chips in my face at aid stations. And I think that helped. I was carrying Martin in a race hydration belt. And by that point, I'd had so much sweet stuff, I couldn't even drink it. So yeah. I just needed that salt. But when the sun went down, I was feeling good. It was still over 90 degrees Fahrenheit, but with the sun down and the temperature down a little bit, I was feeling so much better. I think I still walked most of the aid stations. And by walking the aid station, I don't mean walking 30 seconds at the aid station. I walked the full aid station.
Yeah.
But the last 2 miles, I ran the whole thing in without stopping, and had a time that I think I would have been pleased with for a first one, even if it hadn't been so hot and challenging. So
yeah,
it was a great experience. Crossing that finish line, you know, is something that you can't describe. You have to experience. And I think everyone who's done it knows what that feeling is like. So
yeah, very much so. It must be really tough going to an event that you've trained in sort of less hot conditions and then being faced with, you know, 102, 110 degrees centigrade and water so warm you can't wear a wetsuit. Have you ever experienced being able to run in more temperate conditions, or have all your races just been either ridiculously hot or, like this weekend, turned out sideways hailstones?
Right. Well, I kind of have a knack for picking races with extreme weather. I ran the Stockholm Marathon in 2018 in Sweden. And, you know, when you sign up for a marathon in Sweden, you don't expect it to be 90 degrees Fahrenheit, but it was that day. The rest of the week I was there, it was after the race, it was in the 50s Fahrenheit, I think. So, jacket weather. But I can't say I've never had a good weather race. Actually, 2018 Twin Cities Marathon, I couldn't have asked for much better weather. That was when I ran my my BQ time. I think it was overcast and maybe 60s. It was just beautiful, cool day. I felt like I'd run to my potential. And then last year, I was supposed to be doing the Boston Marathon. Obviously went virtual. I ran that at a park with some people who'd measured out a loop. It was about 8 loops, so 3 and some miles per loop. And again, that day was amazing weather, so that really helped me hit this goal, my sub-3 marathon goal, because I had, you know, the right conditions to do that. So yeah, I've had some good races weather-wise, and I've also had some very challenging ones. So
where did you qualify for the 70.3 World Championships? Tell us about that race.
So that was this year at Ironman 70.3 Des Moines, which was the North American North American Championships.
Yeah.
That was a race I'd signed up for last year in 2020, but was postponed or canceled due to COVID.
Yeah.
So I had a deferral to this year. And so, yeah, I ran that in July. And also last year, I was planning to do Ironman Wisconsin. So shifted basically my whole 2020 season to this year. And I ran Des Moines in June and qualified for the World Championships there.
Nice. And so a lot of people listening are obviously qualifying for the 70.3 World Champs and qualifying for Kona are the two big goals that people have when they get into the sport and start to take it seriously. Tell us about the experience of actually qualifying, the point where you realized you were going to get a slot. Where were you in the day, in the event? Was it after the event? And how did that feel?
It was actually after the event. I was pretty surprised. They didn't do an award ceremony or a slot ceremony like they do at lots of events because of COVID.
Yeah.
You know, in the past, it used to be you have to show up or you don't get your slot, right?
Yeah, right.
And it was the opposite of that. They did a virtual slot allocation ceremony and they asked us ahead of time, if you're offered a slot in the World Championships, do you intend to accept it? And, you know, I said, yes, of course I would. I'm not going to, but I'm not going to say no if they offered me one. So I don't remember exactly how long it was after the race. It was a few days, maybe the next weekend. I really don't remember, but I saw that email and I was pretty shocked to, pretty excited because that was my first 70.3, and to qualify for get a slot offered for the World Championships was just felt unbelievable. So
yeah,
I also looked at the schedule for it and found out it was the week after Wisconsin, which I'd already paid for, you know, and
always the way.
And you probably saw, I remember asking the team, what would you do? And there was a resounding reply on what course of action everyone else thought I should take. And I said, yeah, I kind of got to take this opportunity and go to Worlds. So,
yeah. Yeah. Amazing. All right then. So St. George itself, the event, for those of us outside of America, talk us through the whole thing. Talk us through the setup, the geography, where it is in the country, travel to get there, the whole deal. What's the experience like of getting there?
So it takes place in St. George, Utah, which is the middle of the desert. It has some amazing geography. Utah is pretty well known. And in fact, pretty close, within short driving distance of St. George, there are, I think, three national parks.
Okay.
Like Arches.
I was going to say, is Arches well near there?
Yeah, Arches is near there. Zion is close by.
Yeah.
Bryce Canyon. I don't think that's a national park, but it's an amazing place to visit, I hear. And then there are other places a little further out, like Canyonlands, and the Southwest is a beautiful place. It's St. George is located in the very southwest corner of Utah, so it's also pretty close to Arizona and the Grand Canyon, which is another place I've never been. And it's about an hour and 45 minutes, 2 hour drive from Las Vegas. So,
okay.
I actually flew through Las Vegas, which when I got my slot allocated and started looking at logistics, I only had 2 months basically to plan my trip, which is not a lot for an event like this. And flights were getting booked really rapidly. You could fly into St. George, but there weren't a lot of flights available, and the prices were just going up through the roof. But they're always, and it's a small airport too, so that doesn't help. But there are always lots of flights into Las Vegas, and it's not too bad of a drive. The other consideration with driving was that I'll just say everything eventually turned out really well logistically. I can't imagine planning an event like this and trying to communicate everything or even knowing what everyone needs communicated, but
yeah,
it was a little tough logistically with the information we had from Ironman. Like, the venue is pretty spread out. The swim takes place at a reservoir, which is 15 or 20 miles from St. George. So you get out of the reservoir, hop on the bike. It's a point-to-point bike course, single loop, that ends in St. George, and then it's a two-loop run course. So there's two transition areas, and all the pre-race day events, post-race events, they happen. Ironman Village, those were all in downtown St. George. So thinking about where you stay, but more importantly, how are you going to get your bike 20 miles out to T1? That's a question I actually sent them an email asking, and they didn't have a good answer for. So I needed to rent a vehicle just to make sure that I could get my bike to transition.
Yeah.
So
yeah, it's always tricky, isn't it, with the split transitions, and especially so if you've got to fly into the venue and haven't got your own car with you.
Yeah, and it was tricky. I heard people asking after they got there, how do we get our bikes out there? Because there are shuttles, but you weren't allowed to bring your bikes on the shuttles. So some people were trying to figure that out while they were there.
Yeah.
If you just have a little car that you can't get your bike into, that's a problem.
Yeah. You got to ride your bike out there and leave it and get the shuttle back. That's the,
classic
Ironman Australia.
I saw some people doing that, and those roads the roads were very nice, but when cars are allowed on them, I would not want to be riding on some of those roads that people had to ride to get out there.
So so that's one for the future for people listening then. The logistics of it are you need a vehicle when you're there in order to get around and get the bike to T1 and back again.
Yeah, or find someone to carpool with or something. I actually offered a couple people to take their bikes out there if they needed it, but it seemed like those people, they'd already had that figured out. So
yeah, cool. Okay, so that's logistics kind of sorted. Race day itself then. Have you got to get yourself, presumably you've got to get yourself out to the lake race day morning from your accommodation, get that figured, right?
Yeah, and that part was pretty easy. That was a part where if I had planned my stay a little differently, might have been trouble. What I mean by that is I actually considered staying at an Airbnb out at Sand Hollow Reservoir.
Okay. Well,
they shut down the roads out there, so I would have had trouble. I'm not sure if they were letting local traffic through or not. But the road where I would have been staying out to Sand Hollow Reservoir was definitely closed except to shuttle buses that morning.
Okay.
So it might have been tough. I stayed really close. I might have had a mile walk the morning of to get there.
Well, it dodged.
But the shuttles were really convenient. I think most of the hotels were either near where Ironman Village was, so they had shuttles from there out to Sand Hollow, but they also had satellite shuttles from different areas. They had events near the convention center, which is where a lot of the hotels were, and that's where my hotel was. So it was a short walk to the convention center to take a shuttle to Ironman Village and another shuttle from there to Sand Hollow.
Yeah.
It went even better than that for me. When I got on the shuttle, I don't know if it was supposed to or not even now, but it actually took me from the convention center all the way to Sand Hollow instead of making me take two.
One
to Ironman Village and another one. So that
a direct drop off by the driver, hey?
So I don't know if he sensed my nerves of running a little behind what I wanted to be, but I had plenty of time. I just get anxious about time. So
everyone does, man, I'm sure. So water temperature, you've mentioned already, it's a non-wetsuit swim. Air temperature, water temperature, pretty fine that time in the morning.
Yeah, it was. I don't remember what the air temperature was in the morning. It was not as expected. You know, leading up to the event, even a week before, I was more concerned about the heat than anything.
Yeah.
Desert in Utah. I was looking at the weather, thinking, oh, well, with any luck, I can be done before the hottest part of the day. And who knew that it was going to rain in the desert and I was going to have clouds for most of my race. But the water temperature, the nice thing about it being warm enough that you can't wear a wetsuit is that the water is nice and warm to swim in. But the air temperature was fine. Getting on the bike, it wasn't cold. I think it was over 72 degrees. So,
okay. So I had wondered whether, you know, there's some races over in Europe where Israel Man is a classic where, you know, really nice, warm, sunny days, but everyone who's raced it, it's freezing cold overnight and people get up to do the swim and it's, you know, below 40 degrees air temperature. And even though the water's not that cold, it's, you know, they're absolutely freezing to death when they get out of the water and get on the bike. So I wondered, with it being in the desert, maybe the temperature might drop overnight, but it sounds like that wasn't an issue.
Yeah, it actually didn't drop that much that night. The day before it had, because I got up in the morning, Friday morning, to do my, you know, kind of shakeout ride.
Yeah.
And I was a little chilly and I wasn't even dripping wet at that point. So
yeah,
I felt a little cold doing my bike ride on Friday morning, but not Saturday morning. On race day, it was still room temperature, you know, first thing in the morning. So
yeah, cool.
The only time I was cold was on the shuttle bus because the air conditioner was up too high.
First world problems, eh? So swim then, rolling start. They didn't do age group starts. So they did the sort of five at a time start, did they?
Was both, actually. They did an age group start, and then they had, I think it was maybe 10 at a time within the age groups every 10 to 15 seconds.
Okay. So it wasn't an all in the water together, but they had like a designated start time for, you know, your age group and then the next age group, and they played it that way. And something else that I saw, they had timing mats partway through them. Well, not mats, but how would you describe them? Timing arches and halfway through the swim?
Big inflatable arches. That was something I'd never seen before. You know, in my three triathlons other than sprints. But yeah, they were these big inflatable arches. There were two of them side to side, and you could swim under either one. I picked the wrong one, which is the one everyone else was channeling through. And there was a wire, it looked like, suspended below the arch, and you swim under that, and apparently that could read your chip.
And how big are the arches? How big are we imagining?
Oh, I think they're probably maybe 10 meters, 5 to 10, somewhere between.
Oh,
five
okay.
And 10
meters. So like a finishing banner type.
Yeah.
Type size thing. Yeah. Okay, cool.
Yeah. Wider than the run finish line would be an Ironman event, but
yeah.
Wide enough. They narrow enough that they wanted to have two to make sure that people weren't squeezed too much. But you know, on a swim course, everyone wants to hug the inside as short as you can. So I don't think many people swam through the outer arch.
Yeah, gotcha. Okay. And usually, you know, championship events, the swim tends to be pretty rough, pretty full contact for everybody. Everyone's trying to motor through the water. Was that your experience?
Yeah, absolutely. I had kind of the same experience at Des Moines, actually, even though that was seated more by swim time than it was not age group. And I still kind of had a lot of that experience at Des Moines, but not to the extent that this was, because they told us ahead of time that we would seat ourselves within our age groups, but that didn't really happen. So I started kind of in the middle of my age group and should have been a little further back. And I was running into a few people, but I was getting hit from, kind of bounced around like a pinball between people overtaking me, I felt like. So
it sounds like you got the proper world championships experience there, John. That I don't think you'd have had your money's worth if you hadn't had that experience at a world champs event. So
yeah,
that's good. It's good to know you got that.
Yeah, I haven't experienced the old-fashioned mass start chaos, but I think I got knocked around enough to be happy with that. So
nice. So out of the water. And you're then kind of into your territory, aren't you? Heading out on the bike and heading towards the run. What was the bike course like, and what was the sort of the number of athletes around you?
The bike course was amazing. Almost the entire course, except when we finished the bike in St. George, looked and felt like new blacktop. It was smooth and fast. There were a lot of portions that were, I'd say, false flat. It looked like it was flat, but you check your power numbers or your speed and you're going slower than you think you should be. So you know you're going uphill. Or conversely, wow, I'm going 30 miles an hour. I must be going a bit downhill, you know? And there were lots of the downs made the ups really rewarding. And then if you want to talk about weather, it started out pretty clear, smooth sailing. I think it was maybe in the first 10 to 15 miles, I started getting some crosswind from the east that felt like it was going to knock me over. And I'd been checking the weather all week. My brother always tells me, stop checking the weather. And I finally did, but I knew that there was a good chance there were going to be some storms. And when we started getting wind from the east, I knew that probably meant there was a low pressure system coming in from the west.
Yeah.
So we got the initial winds from the east. I remember turning towards the west with those winds behind me, going down an exit ramp onto the highway, and just feeling like I was slingshotted down that ramp, hitting the downhill. So that was pretty fun. Some more ups and downs heading back towards St. George. And then I saw lightning, and I listened, and I didn't hear any thunder. So I thought, well, maybe we're okay. And I didn't see much more lightning, but as riding along, we started getting towards Snow Canyon, which is where the big final climb is. And it was going uphill, and I hear my brother yell for me. He'd flown out to watch me race, and I gave him the thumbs up, and then I felt the first raindrops. And so we're grinding up the hill. Well, not grinding at that point. There was still, you know, fast cars, but I had to sit up in those winds just to keep from getting knocked over. So we have wind so hard that it feels like the hail or the sleet is hitting me sideways. It's hitting me in the eyes despite having a visor on my helmet. I don't know how that was possible, but it was. And I remember just like whooping and someone kind of giving me the stink eye, like I was crazy, but I was just trying to, you know, like I was there doing it and just trying to stay in the moment and not let any negativity about the weather or anything I couldn't control affect me and just keep after it. So I just kept going, kept climbing. I actually don't even remember the rain stopping. I just remember being on that climb, seeing the sign for Snow Canyon and realizing it wasn't raining anymore and it wasn't windy anymore, but I was just climbing and climbing and climbing. It seemed like an endless climb. I did lots of hill prep, obviously knowing what the elevation profile was like. I got in similar amounts of climbing on training rides back home, but you can't prepare for 7 miles uphill when you don't have a 7 mile hill.
Yeah, it's hard. Yeah. It's like racing Ironman France, something like that, where there's just nowhere to replicate that kind of climbing. Is a 7 mile climb is outrageous.
Right. I mean, you know, you can push your power up a shorter hill and recover on a downhill, but when you don't, just like in workouts, right? I was using Best Bike Split, and for 15 to 20 minutes, it wanted me to maintain 90 to 95% of FTP. And 2 hours into the bike, like that was not possible for me.
You gave it a good go though, hey?
I gave it what I had, that's for sure.
So. Good man. And how did you feel getting off the bike?
Oh, I felt amazing. I skipped over the end of the bike when I got to the top of the hill. I was expecting an amazing view. it was nice. It wasn't this overlook that I was expecting, but the roads were clear and going downhill was so fast. It fastest I've ever been on a bike. And yet it also felt safe.
Okay.
Just because of the roads and how much you could, the visibility was so good. And the roads were good and there's no intersections or anything like that. You could just go. And so I was coming into the end of the bike, I just felt amazing flying down the last 9 or 10 miles in, I don't know, 15 minutes or something. It's just remarkable to go.
It does sound like a really incredible bike course with a bit of everything, great road surfaces, a massive climb, a long but safe, fast descent, great views. It sounds like a kind of epic destination race. You can see why they picked it for the World Championships, I guess.
Yeah, and as cliche as it might sound, a challenging course like this does seem appropriate for World Championships, you know, to conquer a course like that. And I always say that my favorite bike rides are in races when you don't have to worry about stopping for traffic or traffic signals. And on a course like this, where you can really take advantage of that and really see what you're capable of, really makes the bike leg really fun.
So there's a rumor today, I don't know if you've seen this, but there's a rumor that they're considering a fallback for Kona not happening in February is the World Championships Ironman moving to St. George in April or May of next year. Having been there and raced it, do you think it's got the sufficient wow factor for a replacement for Kona, for like a one-year only replacement? What would your opinion on that be?
Well, I did hear that rumor while I was out there. I wonder what they would do. I think it, some people love that venue, other people don't. And I heard both perspectives while I was there.
Yeah. Okay. Some
people just really don't see the appeal in an area like that. But you can tell the people who live there love it. They think it's the best place on earth. And I think it's an amazing place to visit. I wonder how they would double the bike course, you know. Certainly there's plenty of area for them to run. They could turn the swim from a one lap into a two lap swim. I don't know. I haven't experienced Kona though either. I think they would go all out and try and give the best experience they could. You know, Ironman is kind of a premium race experience, and they definitely did extra for the 70.3 World Championships. And I can only imagine for a one-year replacement for Kona, they would do everything they could to try and give the best experience.
Yeah. Okay. Sorry, we went a little bit off topic there, off the side. I still haven't heard about your run yet. Come on, fill us in. So you said you felt amazing coming off the bike. You had the huge downhill, and you had decent run legs as well.
Yeah, so I was actually thinking about this when I got to the top of that climb. You know, I'd been climbing for, I think it's 7 miles, and my legs were feeling a bit tired, but I also knew that I had 10 miles of downhill for them to recover a bit before I started running. And they did, you know. I had in my head that I needed to run by feel, obviously, because it's such a hilly course. And the way that I usually do that is I focus on my breathing quite a bit. So I remember at Des Moines, I'd started out, I felt great. And I was running a little too fast early on, but I felt good. But I realized that I was going into 2-2 breathing way too early.
Yeah.
And it was too hard. So I told myself I wasn't going to let myself go harder than 3-3 breathing.
And so for people who are not from a running background, explain that. Explain what you mean by 2-2 and 3-3 breathing.
Sure. So basically it's breaths per step. So you'll breathe in for 3 steps, 1, 2, 3, and then breathe out for 3 steps. And typically speaking, for 3-3 breathing should be somewhere around your marathon pace in training. 2-2 breathing, you're getting into threshold territory. So if you're breathing, if you're breathing in and out 2 steps, early on in a half marathon, you're going too hard. You can feel you can get into that breathing towards the end of any race and be okay, but not at the beginning. It's definitely too hard.
There's an interesting parallel there between the way that swimmers who swam as a kid learn how to moderate their pace by how frequently they need to breathe, whether it's bilateral, two and two, one and one, whatever that happens to be. But it's something that isn't talked about very often by triathletes who are runners, and that I think it's something that comes quite naturally for a lot of runners. They sort of lock into a rhythm of the breathing with the feet. But if people haven't run as a kid, or are, you know, triathletes who've come to running as part of an adult onset experience, they've very often not heard that talked about before. So that's quite an interesting thing to bring up, actually. I think that'll help quite a lot of people, John. Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things, like everything, that you need to practice, you know?
Yeah.
We do most of our runs easy. I know people who do 4-4 breathing for easy runs. Personally, for easy runs, I don't think you should be even counting your breaths. It should just be easy breathing on an easy run. Yeah. I think if you're doing 4-4, that's probably harder than you need to be. But definitely when you do those steady marathon pace runs, your breathing is, that's a place you can work on, it is your marathon pace runs. But it's only a guide. It only gets you so far, because you can run 3-3 breathing on the easy end, and you can run 3-3 breathing on the hard end. And I guess it's just an experience thing to figure out how that equates to pace, because there's such a wide range. It gets you part of the way there, I would say.
Yeah.
And then experience gets you the rest of the way. So
talk us through the experience of the World 70.3 Championship run from the point of view of someone who was a runner, who's had a good bike leg, and whose run legs feel great coming off the bike. How was the experience of the runners around you and passing people? Because you had what did you run, 134, was it, on that course?
134 or 135.
Yeah. So it was one of the faster runs in your age group. That was a really great performance. What was your perception of the athletes around you?
It was good. I noticed the same thing on the bike, that there were a lot stronger runners around me than I'd experienced at non-world championships events, which I think is to be expected. But that being said, I was passing quite a few people still on the run. Even doing run walk, you know, I was running along slower than I wanted to be, but I was going uphill and I just had to accept that. And I'd pass some people, and then my walk timer would go off and I'd start walking and they'd run by me again, and 30 seconds goes pretty fast. And I'd start running again and I'd pass them, and then I wouldn't see them again because it was another 9.5 minutes before my next walk break. So that always feels good. Like you said, it's kind of for your mindset, being strongest in the run is about the best thing you can hope for, just to get that lift of passing people in the final stage of the race. It's definitely a motivational advantage.
And so through the run itself then, were the times it got hard? Were the uphills hard and steep, or was it more that the uphills were long and draggy and then it was that final downhill into the finish that was a really steep one?
The uphills were super tough. It starts slightly uphill just from the get-go. I think I was probably running right about marathon effort, which for me, my marathon pace is around 6:50 per mile. And I glanced at my watch and I was doing between 7:05 and 7:15. Then you turn from Main Street onto Diagonal and it gets a little steeper, and I was maybe doing 7:20, 7:25. And every turn, the road just gets steeper. And I think on the steepest section on Red Hill, I think it's called Red Hill Drive, I was running 9-minute mile pace uphill. And it was, and even that was maybe too hard at times. When those walk breaks came, I just felt grateful for them.
Yeah. But,
you know, it's a race and it's not supposed to be easy. And I didn't just take it easy on the walk break either. You know, you make yourself do a kind of forced march walk and timer goes off and you get back after it and keep going. And the nice thing about it was, even though it was continuous uphill, it was only about 3.5 or 4 miles and then mostly downhill for the rest. And then you do it all again.
And what was that experience like then of the final hill running down into the finish?
The final hill, it was tough. Your legs are feeling pretty tired. You know, running down a steep hill like that is so hard on your legs. I know people have the problem at the Boston Marathon of running too hard initially and that wrecking their legs for the rest of the race. I think this had the potential to do that too. If you ran too hard down the hill the first time, trash your legs, and then you have to do the up and the down again. So my legs were pretty tired by the time I got to that really steep downhill at the end. Still, I ran it as hard as I could without tripping down the hill. and then it levels off a bit and it's just a nice gradual downhill all the way to the finish where you can just run fast. And that just feels great. You know, it feels like a treat just to be moving fast, but not at extreme effort, just to finish your race that way feels so good.
Nice, man. Well, I'll tell you what then, John, three long distance triathlons in and you've completed the 70.3 world championships. If we'd have said that to you 2.5 years ago, I think you'd have been pretty pleased by the prospect, right?
Yeah, I think so. And not just having completed it, I'm pretty happy with my overall performance too. I had no idea what it would look like going in. A world championship versus the other races I've done, and pretty happy with my overall placement on top of just
nice, finishing, man.
It was never about
you smashed
that.
It, yeah.
It was never about that going in, but it's still nice to see coming out of it. So
cool. And what's next? What have you got lined up for? I hate to ask you this when you're only 3 days post the world championships, but what have you got on your horizon for next year? What have you got your eyes on?
So I'm signed up for Mesa Marathon in February. That's in Arizona.
Okay. Yeah.
I have Ironman Wisconsin, which is in June of next year instead of September. So that's going to be tough to train for an early season full distance Ironman in Minnesota.
Yeah.
But but there'll be a lot of turbo time and long pool sessions, I guess. And then
for the British audience, let me interrupt you there. Sorry. For the British audience, what is your temperatures like during the depths of winter in Minnesota to give people an idea what it goes down to?
The worst temperatures we might get are usually around minus 20 Fahrenheit. That's extreme. That's not most of the winter. I don't think we got near that last winter. It was fairly mild, but even minus 10 Celsius, minus 15 Celsius is not uncommon.
Wow.
So
yeah, my British athletes are complaining about going out for a ride in 4 degrees and rain in the winter, I want them to think about this interview and think about you in minus 15 degrees centigrade, sitting on the turbo and looking out at the frozen tundra out of your window.
Yeah, I can do the runs all winter long, but it just gets one, too cold on the bike, and two, we get so much ice and snow that it's just not safe to...
Yeah.
Do a workout kind of ride in that weather. So we have studded tires for recreational riding and getting around, but it's not the best kind of training if you're training for an Ironman. So,
oh, brilliant. Hey, well, listen, John, thank you so much for your time, mate. It's been great hearing about your experience at the World Championships, and congratulations. You know, you smashed it. You've worked really hard to get there and to qualify. You had a fantastic race and rounded it out with a really super strong run. So I'm really proud of you, man. You did a great job.
Thanks. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure. We'll have you on again in the future when you're at the next World Championships. How about that?
That sounds great.
Cheers, buddy.
Thanks.
Fantastic story there from John Knutsen. Just goes to show what you can accomplish. Athletic as a kid, dedicate yourself to your triathlon training, qualify for the World Championships in your first 70.3 after doing an Ironman as your, effectively as your, well, not your first triathlon, but your first serious distance triathlon. What a legend. Really, really love catching up with him. And great to see you doing so well, John. I'm really proud of you, mate. That's a fantastic performance. I know your teammates were all rooting for you as well and following along online. So we're really, really chuffed for you. That just about brings us to the end of this week's show. I hope you enjoyed hearing firsthand from the horse's mouth about the World 70.3 Championships. One last thing to say is if you've enjoyed the story about how John's been trained and coached with us, if you're interested in finding out more about triathlon coaching, you can head on over to teamoxygenetic.com. I think we've got the most comprehensive triathlon coaching program for busy age groupers. You can book a call with me or the team to have a chat about whether you'd be a good fit for training with us and with Team Oxygen Addict. We've currently got a special offer on if you join for an annual membership before the end of September 2021, you're going to qualify to get your annual membership for the current year's price. Prices go up on the 1st of October, so you're going to be saving yourself £200 against the against next year's 2022 pricing. So get yourself in now. You get training plan, you get meal planners, you get HRV guidance, get aerodynamics advice and seminars from Matt Botterill, monthly coaching calls with the team, weekly catch-up, office hours calls, basically everything that you need to succeed and become the best triathlete that you can be, we are going to offer you. So really, really excited about the new members we've got joining us at the moment. If you would like to be one, click the link in the show notes, book a call with us and have a chat. And also just to say thanks to precisionhydration.com, remember the code OXYGENETIC15 to get 15% off your first electrolyte order. So links in the show notes for all the sponsors so you don't have to remember them. And until next week, have a great, safe training and racing week. I'm Coach Rob Wilby, and you've been listening to the Oxygen Addict Triathlon Podcast. See ya.